Okay, there you see the celebration somehow morphed into calibration. So I had a few things that I was going to write on the first slide in terms of linearity, and things are linear generally in statistics and science, and a lot of other places things go pretty well. But if things get curved, then a lot of things, even like delta methods, start to screw up. Just about everything screws up. And so I'm going to illustrate a bunch of cases where things screw up, and the context, of course, is pretty much the Bayes frequentist divergence or whatever. So what you see up there are a number of names with dates and sort of topics, and I hope to hang my themes on those. One of the dates is kind of early. Some of you by the O might guess what that is. There are a few of the others you know. There's a reference to The Economist, and I will come to that. The question of with the whys really were here, and why are we here? We're here because of statistics, and I think there are a lot of thanks to the organizers and to all the conniving that went on without my knowing beforehand, in particular to Nancy. Why am I here? Well, there are those dumb numbers like 85, 5 times 17 or whatever it is, and I'd rather add 5 and 17 than do the other, but I don't have much choice. All this conference planning was ticking long before I knew if a clock was ticking, and so I was trying to bail out, but Nancy come out strong-armed me. I did come into statistics from another discipline, and at that time there was a book published on probability, and it kind of dominated a lot of things. The group that I was with mostly at that time was mathematicians, and they did talk about it, and some of them thought it was profound, and some thought of it as wrong and offensive, and others were plain mystified, and that mystification and stuff has been sticking with us for a long time, and there is an aura of the religious, and this won't be the last time I'll mention religious here, and I'll even indict it of course centers on what happened a long, long time ago, and paradigms come and go and things morph in various ways. So the book was actually Jeffrey's book, and there was a lot of talk about it. What it, you could think of it, what it really was, is fundamental extensions to what Bayes introduced a long time before it. And he was a geophysicist of very highest stature at the time. And there's always the questionability of fallibility and infallibility. And it's kind of interesting that he vehemently was against plate tectonics. Continental drift did not exist. And, of course, we have Iceland currently, which is on one of the breaks in the Earth's surface, and there is, of course, Hawaii, which is a little bit different from Iceland in a lot of different ways. So you can, various ways you can think about it, there are really deep things involved, like deep within the Earth, and deep within it, there are aspects of telling us how we should think. Well, there are contradictions, and we somehow tolerate those, maybe when we perhaps shouldn't in statistics. So what do sensible people think of this? Well, that might be a little hard to pin down directly, but I will have some references later. There is sort of what people think of statistics. When you're without socially in the rest of it, you don't get always positive responses as to when you report that you're a statistician. And that used to be the way for mathematicians, but they really did something about that. And that's been fairly recent, give it 25 years. 25 years happens to be a magic number. You come up with a new idea, and if it's important, it's not going to show up downstream for another 25 years. So if we're really worried about statistics, we can say what can we do. And I don't think it's good enough to say we have a toolbox. Of course, we have a toolbox, we analyze, we do all things, but somehow some of those tools may be really uncalibrated. And then there are cases where we use our opinions to do the analyses as if we didn't know how to do them otherwise, which maybe we take an easier route in doing that. So if we promote contradictory tools and then just shrug it off and just say, well, it's different ways of thinking, it seems to me like there's a lot of double talk involved when we say that. And the phrase has come up a number of times in the past year that a lot of statisticians generally don't really do what's best for them in the public domain. And I don't think part of statistics we really should be promoting the religious aspect. That flavor comes in, and I'll make some more references to it later. There was an article in The Economist, and that wasn't too long ago, well, not 25 years, 10 years ago, and was a very positive kind of article with a number of things. I'll mention some of them. It referred to the value of a statistical method was now becoming apparent. The results are easier to understand, and clinical trials go faster. Well, that makes me feel a little bit uneasy, but I've been exposed to a lot of drugs in the last few years, not the kind you might think of as street drugs, but the other kind. The article had this phrase in it, it's not bad for an old, dead, white male. This is referring to Bayes. It was there in The Economist, and it just lifted off the page. And there's some more like that. There wasn't much in what the method is. It did say a little bit that it was somehow a mathematical rule. This is, quote, how you should change beliefs. Of course, that is something that pops up in the Bayesian community, belief modification and the rest of it, but that's about all that was in the article. There's a little bit of frequentist bashing, not too much, and there is a quote from Larry that if we pursue some of these two things, then things become more a religion than a science. So I'm not sure, Larry. No, he's okay. And then it ended with, evidently there is life in the old reverend yet. Bayes, of course, was a minister in the church in Great Britain. So that was the Economist's view on it. So all the things sort of center on the theorem, and Peter did sort of mention it, not quite as formally as I did up there. And it's a good theorem, a perfectly good theorem. There are two inputs, density for x and density for y given x, and it's incontrovertible. From that, you get the density for x given y. No problem with the theorem. The theorem's there, and it was there long before Bayes. It wasn't Bayes' theorem. That's just, however, probability morphs around. But when you come to an application, and one of the inputs is missing, and you make it up, it had a bit of cosmetics, and the cosmetics were there because where did the randomness come? Well, he created a billiard table. It wasn't called a billiard table back there, and you roll a ball and you get your probability and analogy, and he put it there, the billiard table, but that wasn't in the context for which he was applying it. And then you claim that the output is valid. Well, I was going to mention this last night, but then the occasion didn't rise. We have a Math 137. We've got a pretty good math department here in Toronto, and I was fortunate to be belonging there. It nurtured statistics, and everything was great. And then along came a computer, and the mathematicians weren't going to have a computer, and so it came to divide, so we went off with our computer. It wasn't more than a couple of years ago when the mathematicians were much better off equipped with computers than we were. So whatever caused the separation, the computers sort of went around, did an end run. So I'll say it's worse than 0/0, but the Math 137 comes up because one of the people present last night, I'm not sure if she's here right now, but is in Math 137. And Math 3170, you do your epsilon deltas, and how do you prove things? There's no way, if you want to prove something down here and you have a perfectly good theorem, you check the first condition, right on, no problem. You check the second condition, oh, it's missing. But I still want to prove that, and it's the end result of the theorem. So you make something up and stuff it in. What would you do in Math 137? She'd be flunked out, and that'd be another daughter in trouble. I mean, a daughter in trouble. Well, just think more seriously of a context for all of this. A typical context, you're in it. Their value of theta is in the past. There is a process that produces data given the theta value, and there's a consequent y, and they're all in the past. They're all in the past. There are things that have happened. If you were wanting to put enough tension in, you'd be able to find their values exactly. And then you ask, what's the question you know about theta? Do we assert probabilities? There's a quote that Neyman has for something that has happened, and Neyman says, Neyman did say way back, you can't put probabilities, either true or false, we don't know. Of course, he had a book at the time where he was calculating conditional probabilities for cards, so he was being theatrical at the time. If you're going to think of that theorem, you have to stop and think of types of priors. So that's the kind of flow picture you have there. If you're thinking of that theorem, there's a process that produces the theta, and then you've got a y that's consequent to that theta, and you get the outcome, you see it's y observed. That's the context. Well, the priors, what can they? They could be real. There could be an own random source that produces it. And there are a lot of baseball examples of that, and a lot of statisticians amazed that you can apply it in that constant. You don't need Bayes or anything. That's just probability theory. A perfectly good random source. What do you call that, where there's a real random source? You think you'd use the term objective. Well, you can't use that because objective then has been taken over by the Bayesian community to refer to a totally different prior. So I'll leave that blank up there. You can use your opinion, your betting instincts, and that has a name that's pretty widely used, subjective. You might quarrel about that. I'll downplay that and just call it opinion, whatever, and whether you can use that for your analysis or whether you should is another issue just at the moment. And then you say something convenient. Well, this is really what Bayes did. He produced a prior for the binomial context, and he gave it an aura of legitimacy by getting the prior from rolling a ball in the billiard table and asserting that randomly it could fall anywhere and it's incontrovertible in that comp. So I'll say that is Bayes, and I'll refer to that as default at this point. As I mentioned before, the Bayes use another term there, but default is probably safer, and there's a paper coming shortly in JRSSB where the term is used, default priors for Bayesian and frequentist inference, and I'll refer to that a little bit later. So you ask, does the theorem apply in these different contexts? In the first case, of course it does. It's just conditional probability. In the third case, no, but then things sort of work. They sort of work because, well, Laplace kind of liked the answers. Laplace's problems were all linear model problems. And if you use this, you get the frequent answer. You get confidence by a faster route, a little illegitimate route, but you do get it. You get confidence. So there's a backward feedback. It must be all right. And a lot of the arguments that you read going back there are trying to make it look like you can argue the legitimacy of the theorem from kind of invariance arguments or something, but in that kind of context, there's no conditioning, it's just a marginal calculation like confidence inference. So we'll get rid of the dark colors and get into something. This is on the theme of linearity versus curvature, and it's kind of elementary pictures. I thought of getting piles of normal probability on the plane, so you can think of your unit mass of probability shifting around and being different things, but I'll try to illustrate it by just having a couple of circles, one representing one sigma context for something that's normal, 0, 1, normal, arbitrary normal somewhere on the plane. So one sigma context contours and two sigma contours, so you can picture that as your pile of probability sitting there. If you get a data point on the plane, and I'll think of its horizontal distance over as being y1, is you get an observed value 6. And so what I'm thinking about is testing that first coordinate y1. thinking of an interest parameter psi of theta being linear in this case. So this is the linearity versus curvature. Those are the contours of a linear parameter, and we have y1 and measurement variables and theta1 and theta2, the thing being measured. So you can think of everything on the plane. You can plot parameter and data at the same time. So if you get a data where the horizontal distance over is 6 and you're interested in the parameter is over 7 units, you're one standard deviation to the left. Probability of the left of the data is given by that vertical green thing. Probability left is just the 1 unit point in the standard normal. That's 16% on one side, 16 on the other, the 66 in the center. So your p-value is 16. You're saying where the data is with respect to the parameter. Linearity is fine. So then you say, what would Bayes say? Well, what Bayes says, well, this is a case where uniformity on the plane, it's the pure Bayesian case. It's a flat prior on the plane. It's one of those improper ones that Peter was getting a little bit edgy about this morning, but not really. Uniform on the plane. So what Bayes says is that the normal is centered at the data point. So the distribution of the parameter is normal there with an identity covariance matrix. So here's on the parameter space, and you have a normal distribution centered at your data point. And that's the switch, a distribution centered on the parameter, a distribution centered on the data. So this is the location case where everything is pure and the rest of it. And you do your calculation, and so you want probability larger than that 7. You look to the right, probability larger. I'll call that the Bayesian posterior survivor value. That's the same 16%. 16% to the right on the parameter space, 16% left on the sample space, and those values are equal. 16% for both ways. Bayes is right on, Bayes works, Bayes is easy and exact. But suppose you think of a curved parameter. So I've taken it easy by just having something quadratic. I took it square root, so that I'd be looking at distance on the plane. I had the same dimension. So there's a curved parameter centered back here, and here are the contours of it. And again, thinking of the 7 units over, just like in the preceding, but our parameter is now curved. And we say probability left of the where the data is, you're measuring distance to a certain contour. There's the sample space distance 6, that's using the data points 6 and the parameter at 7. I put the line through the pair of them, like if we're just thinking of a distance over 7, that's the point that corresponds to it. And you say, what's the probability left where it's shaded? Well, that just comes out of the non-central chi-square distribution. You look it up, R, and get the value. You get a p-value of 14.1%. Now, here's where the curvature comes in. You get go to the parameter and say, well, the parameter distribution is centered here, and I'm interested in the probability of being larger than 7, illustrated by the arrows. That's another straight calculation in R. And this is the distribution function non-central chi-squares, but it's something different down here. This works out to 17.8%. Those are different. Why are they different? Well, you think of a pile of probability, and you take a chunk out of this, like the Apple Macintosh apple, take it out here. Down here, you have the same pile of probability, same distance away, but your contour is curved the other way. So when you switch from the frequentist to Bayesian, you're changing things in different directions. And that's in the nature of Bayes. If things are nonlinear, it screws up directly and immediately. Well, it isn't just for those two values. Still thinking of the 7 value and think of other data points. 7 coming back to 6, 5, 4, the p-value, and the Bayes survivor value. Well, there's the ones we just looked at, the 14 and 7, 47, 52, 1.9, 2.8, 10.8. They're uniformly different, and so you run across, and if you have positive curvature, the Bayes value is always greater than the p-value. Well, that has kind of implications on what your accuracy is going to be when you come to use this. You're going to be uniformly wrong using that kind of calculation. And so, hence that calibration, celebration, whatever, uncalibration maybe is the theme. So it's uncalibrated unless everything is linear. If everything is linear, the original Bayes is fine, it's just consonants. If things go nonlinear, well, it's sort of approximate consonants. Maybe you'll be all right, maybe not. Well, two ways of thinking at the same problem. What you sort of see is hidden in David Stone and Zittick. They think of things in a different point of view. And it's a few years after 1973, so you can some sense saying some kind of usage of the paradigm are, well, perhaps broken. Well, it doesn't happen just with parameters that can curve. You can think of models as being curved. So you can think of a normal, location normal, but the variance I'll take to be 1 plus a correction. Where does the n come from? Think of some antecedent sample size. That's where kind of asymptotics comes in. It allows you to focus in and examine things, sort of like in a differential sense. Suppose we get a little bit of curvature, and in this case you can attribute it back to some prior sample size and composing the models to get something current. If the gamma is equal to 0, that's just location normal. And so you want the beta lower confidence bound. You take your data value and subtract off the normal allowance, and you get theta hat beta, the lower beta lower confidence bound, and the beta was 90%. That's a lower bound that would have 90% confidence, not quite in the way Fisher talked about it, but in the Neyman's follow-up, where he says you don't just throw the distribution on the parameter space, you choose sets on, do your inversion. So it's the Neyman development from that. And that accuracy, well, it's not immediately clear. If you take this normal, put that in, how to get the confidence intervals, it's a couple step iteration. That's not exact. It's accurate to the third order, and third order typically really gets things pinned down pretty well. You do it with a couple of inversions. So you can see what the correction, there's the Z beta, that's the first term, but you have this extra term that comes up doing the standard curvature. So you say, well, what could I do by choosing a prior? There are a lot of steps in seeing going from the distributions through, carrying this through. You have to work with likelihood and then bring in the prior and see what could happen. But what will a prior do? It won't get you to anything like this. What the prior will do is actually shift the confidence bounds to the right or make it more concentrated. It won't give you something like that. That term says you have a quadratic effect around your data point. And the Bayesian adjustments cannot do that. The only way you can get Bayes to do that is have a data-dependent prior. And Larry Wasserman has talked about data-dependent priors, and he's kind of Bayesian at times. We all know that. But with data-dependent, he has a nice example where the only way you can do it right is to have a data-dependent prior. Here's a much simpler example, just a location normal, where you have that the variance depends a little bit on the mean. You cannot find any prior that'll get to the confidence result. And you say, well, maybe the Bayesian has some deeper religious, scratch that, maybe has some deeper sense that it can accomplish something like that. I think David and Stone and Zittick really didn't broadcast in their paper the real message that underlies the calculations or some of the calculations too. And then the last remark there is kind of a throwaway remark that having to do with whether you're going to use your personal feelings to do it. Well, if you use your personal feelings, put them up there and people to see it, and do your statistics and find out something that's reliable. And then if you want to put them together for a user, that's fine. But there's no reason why you have to give up and use the opinions to do the calculations, or why you need to think and summarize them in that form. Well, saying it sort of bluntly, Bayes can't handle curvature, you call a number probability? Does it have, and it doesn't have performance properties, is what we just saw. Is it sort of more deception that we're implicit in? I'm not sure whether we're really blamed for Wall Street, but maybe we shouldn't be duplicit here. Well, the question, does it matter? There's a paper in the Phil Trans Royal Society by these authors in Great Britain, and it has to do with weather models, different measurement processes involved, flat priors for parameters. Now, in these big models, very often you can't pin down certain of the parameters. They'll put in a flat prior for the parameter and then run many, 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 many simulations, and they were finding that change something, then you get totally, totally different results. Contradictory results, fairly bluntly. It's not an easy read, and I won't say that I've read any major percentage of it, but okay, The Economist picks it up and talks about gambling on tomorrow, and that's a little bit more recent. That's August, a couple years ago, and several remarks. The way you pick the individual values to plug into the model can cause trouble, and this was picking up values to put in for the flat prior. It came about because with different models, then the parameters were coming from different sources, so what could be viewed as flat in one case wouldn't be flat in the other case. So how you pick your values, that was being commented here. And these are comments. The Bayesian bolt-on does not come easily to scientists. And also the phrase garbage in and garbage out, and then it sort of concluded with the remark, the difficulty comes when you do not know what garbage looks like. And that was sort of a reference to this paper. So the question, should we ignore those things in the major British journal, and then also in the, call it the popular, semi-popular press? I think you can think of putting a prior on and doing analysis as a great way to explore. It's not really Bayes, it's just that the Bayesians grabbed the frequentist likelihood before the frequentist really got their voice out. So if you take the likelihood function and say you're going to weight it and then do some feedback analysis, you're getting what the frequentist really should have done rather than it get presented in the Bayesian framework. The Bayesians are happy to grab those original ones where I refer to there is an objective Bayesians, and happy to grab the benefits from the frequentist analysis and confidence. So more generally, you can think of it as giving approximate confidence. Sort of the analysis, when you put in a default prior of some sort of time, is it won't be conditional. It really will be marginal in terms of what you have. Conditional analysis doesn't really press, and it gets its validity as so how close it is going to be confidence. And I don't think you can argue with priors used, convenience priors, that it can give anything more than confidence, so it's maybe a quick and, I've used the phrase, a quick and dirty confidence. Won't repeat that out loud, the claim. So maybe the toolbox needs a bit of calibration and we shouldn't kind of shrug it off. Those are a few references to some background papers and a few current ones. The joint work with Anna Maria up there on conditioning. Papers with Nancy. Some of those papers you can have a look at if you're curious. They're on my website. This talk isn't there yet. I'll try to have it up later today or certainly tomorrow. So, thank you. It's been fun. Well, I can think of Dave Andrews at, on one or more occasions sort of shrugging and saying, all I need is a mean and standard deviation. So it's how much kind of overhead you're going to bring in. But there are a lot of cases where models are pretty well defined, and to shrug them off as being subjective, as the Bayesians will argue, is kind of missing the point, I think. So in terms of trying to answer your question more generally, I won't attempt more than that, Jerry. What is a parameter? I'm abstracting. You're at Peter's talk. Well, sort of, what is a parameter? What's a model? And I mean. Peter has commented on parameters as being something that really should mean something in the application or context, rather than being an artifact of the model. So I think I'm fully supportive of that. And that comes up in some recent looks on the Box and Cox model, which has been around for a long time too, because there you have whatever the regression model parameters are, and then you put a power transformation or something in to get your expression for the data. And when you do that, that power parameter kind of masquerades a lot like something that would be a quadratic thing in the linear model and the fender. So things are really, really confounded there. And so in that case, you can get likelihood functions with night badges. You can get beautiful Hessians that are the wrong sign and stuff just because your points miss the ridge and stuff. So. Well, they're artifacts of the model. I'm not trying to sort of say what Peter would say, but that they're not meaningful in the applications. They're just something where they were contrived in the model. So, what are parameters? If you're talking about parameters for interest, I think you'd look for the ones that had some reality in the context that were not sort of contrived in the model.
In my mind, they're all supposed to come from some kind of evidence. If you want to use that type of parameter, you have evidence that the prior should be different. I have a lot of trouble with Bayesian too. I heard a talk the other day in which there was a lot of discussion about the prior that you use when you're designing studies, and then there's a different prior you use when you're analyzing. That didn't make much sense.
Well, yeah, Peter.
So, in response to Art's remark there about the prior, there's a recent RSS discussion paper where exactly this issue comes up, having to do with sampling in spatial context, or in a solution or the like, where analysis might be very different from the person or individual who produces
they might get together and try to resolve the problem. But I agree, if the prior has been used and you've got the data, then you're starting over with the evidence that you have at that point. I did notice that Don was using the word "use," like that you do this and then you do that. So that, I was figuring he's really a person.
He did assume there was a theta attached to the value. I think that's part of the point. That it's just a construction of reality to represent yourself.
In the default case, or you meaning, or?
Well, you take something to represent the world.
it's adaptive. It changes from slide to slide.
I sort of presumed to answer Art's question. In science, the world, you try and learn those things like this. Sometimes you have to go to great lengths to decide to tolerate it. So, for example, the effect of a drug might be to change the rate of decline of something, or the rate of improvement, in which case you would choose to measure the effect of the result and rate of improvement. And statisticians might try and generalize that by calling that a random test. But there are nothing but precision on how we're going to measure effects. I'm sure you
maybe the question again briefly, or how can we do to? Oh, okay. Sort of. My question went out. And now it's coming back. Well, I guess one of the things is sort of not dealing with this duplicity, where you have sort of two things that you could apply to the problem, and not really addressing the fact of why they're different. And this one mentioned these are fairly specific things in terms of well-defined models and two things that get different results. And I think in the flat priors get used, they get used all over, they get used in the chemical industry. And so if there's a curvature effect, it does need to be addressed. And I sound off about this periodically, so all I need is a chance. Well, I've never seen any other that seems suitable candidate. Part of my argument is discrediting the Bayesian. So the Bayesian is what you use default priors. If there really is a real prior, there is a question, and it's not even statistics, it's probability theory, we can leave it to them. If you're using opinion or whatever to analyze it, maybe you should separate that. Let the opinion be up so people to see it. Let the analysis come up with confidence bounds. That's just purely reporting, where if you come up with a distribution for something and there's a parameter of interest, it's going to produce a bound with a certain number attached to it. Just checking whether that number makes sense, and confidence does give that. evaluating the quantile on whatever your probability distribution is that you're coming up with, Bayesian frequency or anything else. Well, if you're thinking of coming up with a 90% lower bound for a scalar parameter, and you come up and say, this is my thing, in theory, every one of those can be checked, whether it was right or wrong, and then you've got a record if you could see what those are, and if you're giving something that's uniformly off from what that record is, you've got to explain that, and I think using personal probabilities to explain it is sort of like giving a bad image to the discipline. Now, of course, I realize I'm off on one side. And
I don't know what you want to say.